From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In our weekly look at things around the Caribbean and Latin America, we discussed with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, an election this past weekend in El Salvador, and the ongoing situation in Venezuela. It was a bit of a surprise in the outcome of that election in El Salvador, right?
The election in El Salvador was a surprise in the sense that the guy that won, Bukele, Nayib Bukele, he won with 53% of the vote. That is kind of, and over the last six elections since the end of the effective dictatorship in El Salvador in the early 90s. And this is the first election really in which there's been such a clear win, and such a clear win for somebody that is neither of the two historic parties. There have always been antagonists in El Salvador, the progressive Frente Furibundo Martí party, the FMLN, and the extreme right-wing party originally founded by death squad leader Roberto d'Aubuisson called ARENA.
Right.
And over the last five or six elections, it's always been those two parties that have slogged it out. In the previous two elections, the FMLN won, but not by much. And in this election, all that kind of format, that schema of political configuration, has been completely broken by this victory by Nayib Bukele. Now, who is, and I don't feel optimistic at all about the election result, because I see that very much in the same mold as Jimmy Morales and to some extent Jair Bolsonaro and Mauricio Macri in Brazil and Argentina respectively, because Bukele won on this phony platform, an anti-corruption platform, when his right-wing backers, because he's his Ghana electoral front was basically a centre-right political movement.
Right.
And he's backed by right-wing business people in particular, who was corrupt as hell. So it was ridiculous of voters to swallow the anti-corruption line, but that's what happens, isn't it? And that's what happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro. It's what happened in Guatemala with Morales. It's what happened in Ecuador with Moreno, and so on and on and on. And it's always the same. The voters get hit with an extremely slick but also extremely superficial media propaganda campaign on behalf of this, in this case, a young, personable candidate who was mayor of San Salvador and was not an unsuccessful mayor during his tenure as mayor of San Salvador, but nor was he especially successful. So and that's one reason why he did well. But what I found somewhat disturbing was the extent to which the FMLN failed, because I thought that they'd at least get over 20% of the votes and maybe even get into a possible runoff. But nothing like that happened. I was completely wrong about that. They slumped to something like just under 14% of the vote, which is unheard of in El Salvador. They've always got well over 20%, unless I'm misremembering.
And you know, he was mayor of two different municipalities, in the latest San Salvador, as FMLN party member and candidate. And then he was basically kicked out for wrecking it, promoting internal division and defamatory acts against the party.
Absolutely. He's a very, very divisive figure. And also, he's far from squeaky clean himself, and he's just been very good at covering his tracks. So, it is quite disturbing that Salvadoran voters should have turned their backs so categorically on the FMLN party, which is the only party of the three that had well thought out policies to benefit the impoverished majority in El Salvador. It's just it's just baffling how it could be that they slumped to such a low a portion of the vote. But that's what happened, and what we'll see is what we've seen in Argentina and Guatemala all these other places where similar figures to Bukele have won.
Yep.
And they'll betray their election promises. They'll promote neoliberal policies. They'll side in the international arena. It's very bad news for progressive governments because Bukele is certain to line up as yet another puppet of the U.S. authorities in for example in votes in the OAS
right
and elsewhere.
That's going to be interesting. His campaign. Apparently, you know, the question of, wait a minute, your politics or FMLN, you know, what are you doing with Ghana, which is a right-wing, center-right, whatever, but a right-wing party. And his campaign said, essentially, look, they're the only other existing party where I could run to be, you know, for a presidential campaign, my politics have not changed. And so now, of course, we're going to see, oh, here's a foreign policy decision to make. Do we support the United States at the OAS or Venezuela, you know, the proof is going to be in the pudding.
Yeah, I might be wrong about Bukele's position vis-a-vis Venezuela, but I doubt very much. He ran on a center-right ticket.
Yes, he did.
And he can lie and try and fool people as much as he likes about what his real politics were. But he's a center-right social democrat, and that's why the FMLN threw him out because he was trying to change their policies in favor of people at grassroots.
Lenny Moreno could run as a leftist and govern as a right winger. So I assume you can run as a right winger and govern as one without too many questions.
And it's that oldest ploy in kind of centrist politics, isn't it? Faint left, go right, and it works every time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. So
then, you know, and that, and maybe we should start talking about Venezuela in that context because it's like, and maybe I'm wrong about Bukele, and maybe he will at least abstain in votes in the OAS and the United Nations, but I doubt it. He and his circle are going to cave in to U.S. pressure.
Yeah. Well. I mean, and El Salvador going that way, of course, is not great news for Nicaragua either.
No.
It's another neighboring country to look over your shoulder at.
Yeah, and Nicaragua has been scrupulous about not interfering in the internal affairs of its neighbors, either in Honduras or Guatemala or Costa Rica.
Right.
And certainly not in El Salvador. And they've always maintained very cordial relations with their northern neighbors. It's been Costa Rica that's been the country that's constantly trying to interfere in Nicaragua's internal affairs. But let's see. But as the U.S. offensive against Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, and next, of course, will be Bolivia, and we'll see that later in the year.
Right.
As that offensive intensifies, the pressure on phonies like Bukele to toe the U.S. Diplomatic line will be intense, and he is not going to resist it.
Right. Well, we shall see. Yeah, so, all right, Venezuela. Well, since we last spoke, this past weekend, I don't know, it looked hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people gathered on Saturdays to support President Maduro and the government. There were opposition rallies, but looking at the aerial photography, which was, there was an extensive documentation of who had how many people where. I would say that it was like 10 to 1, the turnout for the government. If you're looking at this being decided in the street, it may well have been decided this past weekend. Now, President Maduro spoke for an hour. He was very confident. He was very well received. And he threw the ball back at the opposition in a very clever way, I thought. And I think also a very intelligent, you know, an honest thing, something that would be constructive. He said, yeah, you guys want to have a new election, It shouldn't be for president. We just had a presidential election. But we have this National Assembly that's in this state. It's legally frozen. It's politically, you know, at least in an ambiguous state. You're trying to spring a president from this. Why don't we have new elections for the National Assembly and then move forward from there? And that's what he put out on Saturday, and hasn't been much spoken about that here.
No, and I should imagine that the corporate media, the international corporate media, will completely quash that. They won't give it any... Sorry, Don. Big truck going by.
So it sounded like the army's landing. They didn't want to hear that.
Yeah, the international corporate media are certainly going to quash that news because it shows, as you say, it shows that Nicolas Maduro is prepared to go to an election. It may be not the election that the opposition won, but then the thing is that you now have the European Union countries, although not as the European Union, because that was
Italy.
Vetoed by Italy and Greece, apparently.
That's right, yep.
A large number of the Western European countries, more than anything, recognizing Guaido as what they call an interim president, which doesn't even figure in the Venezuelan constitution. It's nonsense in legal terms. And what they'll say and what the United States will say and what the Venezuelan opposition will say, well, we can't have elections unless they're run by the United Nations.
Right.
And like in Haiti, right?
Right.
Where in election after election in run by the United Nations, they've been a complete farce.
Yeah.
So, and I don't see... I'm very pessimistic about the situation in Venezuela from one point of view and optimistic from another point of view. And I think the agenda that's being generated by the United States and its supine European allies, you can more or less write off the Venezuelan opposition as having any say at all in the process, because they just do what they're told.
Right.
The agenda that's being generated leaves no room for anything but military intervention.
Which I don't think is going to—it's almost impossible to win it that way, given, you know, it's no accident that the United States did not invade Cuba after the Bay of Pigs. Aside from the Soviet, guarantee of its security, quote unquote, and the promise not to invade, which of course, that of course would restrain the U.S. from going after something that it wants. The fact of it was that the development of the people as a resistance force, as a military resistance force, the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, the entire organization of the society as a people's army, in essence, that was the thing. Going in there, you're fighting until the last Cuban is dead, basically. That's the only way that you conquer Cuba under those conditions. And, you know, Hugo Chavez came from the military, was very close to the military, brought the military to the people and the people to the military, and he was with, you know, with the Cubans from pretty much the beginning of his time in office. And so I can't... And look, and not only that, by the way, there's the example of the coup being undone by the people.
Right.
So
yeah,
I don't think a military intrusion into Venezuela turns out well for the invaders at all.
Well, no, I was going to go on and say, and I think I agree with everything that you said. I was going to go on and say that is why the United States, in my opinion, for what that's worth, that is why the United States is bound to fail. And in our last conversation, I put it to you that the only question is what kind of the defeat the United States is going to suffer this time. And I still think that, because if you look at the internal situation, Nicolas Maduro did an interview with a Spanish reporter the other day, and the Spanish reporter was quoted as saying, I thought this was quite interesting, actually.
Yeah.
He was quoted as saying, he was completely struck by the total calmness and serenity of Nicolas Maduro and everybody in the government that this Spanish TV reporter met. And his take on that was, well, either we've been fed completely false information about the internal situation in Venezuela, or they are completely isolated from the people. That was his conclusion. Now, we know from the events on Saturday that it's ridiculous to claim that Nicolas Maduro and his government are isolated from the people. And so that leaves us with what you and I know already, that the information that this Spanish reporter had been going on in his attempt to understand what's happening in Venezuela is all completely false.
So
what do you have there? You have this categorically unquestionable reality in Venezuela of a substantial minority, but still a minority in the opposition, that are determined to be recalcitrant and refuse to negotiate or recognize the constitutional government of Nicolas Maduro, and they have bet on foreign intervention to get them what they want. But against that, you have a solid majority of people in Venezuela who actually support their constitution, do not want foreign intervention. I think the figure in a recent poll was 80%.
80+%, yeah.
Yeah. And that is the reality. And you have the reality whereby the government... Okay, so what has the U.S. government done? It's imposed all these sanctions that up until now the Venezuelan government has managed to counter more or less successfully. You know, obviously with all kinds of problems, but they're coping. And so what the United States has done is it's impounded Citgo, which has something like $7 billion of assets.
Right.
But that doesn't have an immediate effect on the Venezuela's economy. And what the Venezuelans have said is, well, if you want any oil, you're going to have to pay for it in advance.
Right.
So what that means is that unless the United States is going to start sanctioning its own oil companies to stop buying oil from Venezuela, they're going to find that they don't have any oil to refine in all those Citgo refineries that they just impounded.
Yep.
So, and it's just...
And you know, and this again, this is happening, this is, I'm sorry, but this is happening again as we come into a term where OPEC is going to be chaired by Venezuela.
Right. Right. And so, and there's all that, okay? So, and Venezuela... is going to start selling its oil elsewhere. The United States is going to find that it doesn't have the oil that it's been accustomed to having to supply its East Coast refineries. Citgo, in effect, is going to be a burden, not an asset.
Right.
Although it's true that something like $11 billion in is the phrase upstream value from Citgo's activities over the next few years. Yeah. That's what the United States reckoned they were hitting Venezuela with.
Right.
Well, that all the Venezuelans are going to do is work out other strategies for dealing with this crisis.
Right.
Well, and that's what's going to happen. They're going to be supported by Russia and China. So what is the United States then going to do? What they're talking about at the moment is trying to institute some kind of humanitarian corridor.
Yeah.
Well, the only way they can do that is by a military intervention. So there's apparently some military activity in the area near Cucuta, down there on the border, on Venezuela's border on the Colombian side.
This would be in the face of the UN, by the way. Guterres said last week that humanitarian aid that comes through the UN goes to the government, which is headed by President Nicolas Maduro. So,
yeah, of course,
so you're talking, yeah.
No, No responsible humanitarian organization is going to give humanitarian aid to a character like Guaido, who controls no territory and has no infrastructure for distribution of the of the aid, or certainly no trustworthy infrastructure. So that and all that, it's like a theater of the absurd, and it's so difficult to see what's going to happen. And we will see what happens, but yes. It's impossible to see any rational outcome or any rational procedure that the United States and its ridiculous European allies, they're so pathetic. There aren't words to describe how pathetic the Europeans are in relation to Venezuela.
Well.
And what just, they have, and somebody said, I've forgotten who it was. I think it was one of the European ministers. They said, well, we'll go along this far with the United States, but we don't see that they have any plan B. And of course they don't have any plan B, because they don't, and it's just completely irrational.
Look at Syria. What was the plan B for Syria?
What's happening in Venezuela is what happened in Nicaragua last year, but on a much larger scale. And what happened is that the United States thought that with a cuff and puff, they blow everything down.
Right.
Well, it didn't work. And it seems they seem to be operating on the same logic in Venezuela. They've huffed and they've puffed. And the Venezuelan government is still there. And Venezuelan society is still functioning. And the Venezuelan economy is still functioning. So what are they going to do now?
Now, here's something else, too. To me, this is and I mentioned this in another interview that I had earlier today, but we'll discuss later. The social fabric in Venezuela is stratified, heavily stratified according to class, historically, and a very strong, almost to a person, identification with race and or indigenous status. The white folks that were descended from the Spanish are the upper middle class, and a couple of them among them are the actual elite. And then folks of African heritage and indigenous heritage here are the workers and the very, very poor. And that is not uncommon for the entire region, certainly, but it's very strongly rooted there. The Bolivarian Revolution did huge progress to remediating a lot of that. You know, when you talk about building 2.5 million housing units, for example, it helped to remedy the imbalance in housing distribution between those two groups of people. Almost all of the other things, healthcare, education, electricity, etc., that rides along that. Now, you have a situation where the government, the constitution developed by these people, the government elected by these people, is taken away from them by the Europeans. Now, let's talk about which Europeans they are. Spain, Portugal, UK, France, Belgium, the Netherlands. These are the colonial powers that were here raping and pillaging for the first few hundred years here. They just left. Some of them still haven't left. And now they're going to say who should be president of Venezuela. To half the population of Venezuela, that looks very bad. The optics, that's the term they like to use at the times. Real bad optics. And now take a look around the neighborhood. What do you think goes through the minds of the people in Brazil, which is also evenly divided along similar lines?
And the army in Brazil have already told Bolsonaro that they're not interested in intervening in Venezuela. Yeah. But there's a political electoral statistic that is also relevant, Don. I think what you've just said is extremely relevant and all too easy to forget. But and going back to kind of more Eurocentric way of looking at things, and in terms of, in electoral terms, there was a study by the very, very well-trusted Hinterlaces organization, polling company that's trusted by both sides. And Hinterlaces came out with a poll just the other day in which they said, do you remember we were saying last week, or I was suggesting last week, that there was something like 30-35% for the Chavistas and something like 20-25% for the opposition. Well, it was very interesting that Hinterlaces actually bore out that view, which is in any case based on the polling, previous polling in previous years, right, by companies like Hinterlaces, they put 19% as outright supporting the opposition, 33% outright supporting Chavismo,
right,
and the remainder kind of floating. So what you've got is something like 48% floating.
Right.
Now, if you go back to what we were saying last week about, you know, in any election there's 15% that don't vote.
Right.
Well, that would leave, that would probably, assuming that the 19% opposition all turn out, the 33% Chavistas all turn out,
right,
15% don't vote, let's say that leaves 33%,
yeah,
of the 48% voters.
Right, right, right.
So the Chavismo would only need kind of a third of those, or a little more than
third. That's right.
In order to win.
That's right.
And that is why, in the last presidential election, the right-wing opposition didn't take part, because
right,
they knew they'd lose. They knew they'd lose, and their strategy was to try and delegitimize the election by boycotting it, because
right,
they knew they'd lose.
Yep.
And going back to what you said earlier about the parliamentary, the proposal by Nicolas Maduro to bring forward the parliamentary elections.
Right, right.
In fact, I don't think it was Maduro that proposed it. I think it was a proposal that came out of the Constituent Assembly, and Maduro seconded it.
Well, by seconding it, it's like, oh, by the way, as the president of Venezuela, yeah, why don't we do, I'm saying to you guys, why don't we do this?
I
didn't mean to make it sound like it was
that
his.
That Constituent Assembly is more powerful than the president.
That's right. Absolutely. Yep.
Right. Because they are the literally the voice of the people, and
yeah,
they
literally
decide what's going to happen.
Yep. Literally.
And that, of course, is why the Europeans and the United States stay completely quiet about the Constituent Assembly.
You don't want anybody getting ideas about having those things, like, say, in Paris, for example, right now.
Right, yeah, sure. As if. Anyway, so what that all means is that the chances of the opposition agreeing to bring forward the parliamentary elections are zero.
Right.
Because they know they'll lose.
Right.
At the moment. I think what's likely to happen is because President Trump is so volatile, and he'll, you know, he'll turn around and say, well, night is day today, but then a week later he'll say, oh, no, I got that wrong, day is night. And that's what he'll do. He's likely to do with Venezuela. So we've got all this huffing and puffing about Venezuela. My feeling is, I hope I'm right, because a military intervention, as you said, would be just absolutely catastrophic. My feeling is that the United States won't go for a military intervention, that they'll do one of these turnarounds that Donald Trump is a kind of a maestro pulling off. And things will just chunter along at a relatively low level while the United States waits for conditions in which it will be possible for their opposition to win an election. And in the meantime, they'll just try and sustain constant instability through their puppet Guaido.
Right.
I agree. My feeling is that is how it's going to go, because I don't think even the United States wants a military intervention. Even crazy people, manic sadists like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams.
Yeah.
And I think even they are going to have to face the reality that it will not do them any good.
Here's what I think in addition to that. I agree completely. There's a domestic side to it also. You've had, since Trump's election, this like faux left inciting a faux revolution, you know, et cetera. So, and those who are actually, you know, interested in seeing an actual revolution in the United States have never had anywhere to go before. So there's some cohesion between those two groups. Even though there are so many contradictions, obviously, such as having CIA on your side as you make revolution. But if the U.S. were to have a bipartisan invasion of Venezuela, because I don't see Schumer and Pelosi walking away from this, there's going to be a split in what they thought was going to be a united front. And that little kernel could change the nature of the revolution in the United States. And we're out of time, Tony. Right. Thanks a lot.
Well, let's hope you're right, Don.
We'll see.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.